singing and making melody. Isn't that what we all need to do? Great exhortation there. Well, good morning, fellas. It's Matt and Chris here on the Daily Connection today. Matt and Chris from Trail Christian Fellowship, who once a month come into the studios here and beguile us with their knowledge of church history.
I thought you said wreak havoc.
I think it was the other. But anyway, great to have you guys here again. And we began with a little bit of music from William Billings, New England psalm singer. You know, what do colonialists do to have a good time? Well, they get together, literally, and they sing songs. And, of course, it was a problem with the clergy that the singing was not up what it should be. And so there were singing societies and singing congregations, and they would get together and practice and, of course, praise the Lord, and they needed some music. And so William Billings, the first published colonial composer, wrote this New England psalm singer in 1770. Now, that's a little before the time we're going to be concentrating on today, which is the Great Awakening. And hope you guys can kind of enlighten us about this part of American church history, okay?
Actually, Pat, the 1770 is actually after the period we're talking about today, that we're speaking this morning on what's known as the Great Awakening, and this was actually a series of revivals that were happening in different parts of the American colonies, really between the years of 1735 to 1745. And really, the significance of this 10-year period is how it really shaped both the life of our nation and also our religious experience as a country. Just kind of to set the stage as far as some of the other things that maybe people are familiar with during this time era, in 1735, this was the date in which both John Adams, who was later to become the second president of the United States, and Paul Revere, who we know from his famous Midnight Ride.
Sure.
They were both born that year in 1735.
Huh.
And also, if you'll remember last month, our program about John Wesley, it was during this period that John Wesley had his evangelical conversion. And he had been a Christian and been a churchman, but at this point, the Holy Spirit had done a work in his heart right around 1738. And this was also the time of the great philosophers Voltaire and David Hume, who had a very profound effect on the academy and even upon the church with their particular philosophy.
Not to say that it was a bed of roses. As a matter of fact, you'll remember this is about 100 years after the Puritans. So right off the get-go, what we're looking at is a society in colonial America that's actually commercially doing pretty good. You know, things are popping, sales are up.
They have money to buy a second powdered wig.
Don't start with the wigs. Commercially and materially, the colonies are prosperous and things are going well.
Okay.
However, they are experiencing, they're the third generation since the initial Puritans, and the difficulties of life are not with them as they were with their forefathers. And as you might guess, there was a certain laxity of spiritual feeling. It just didn't feel like a pressing need. And if I may say so, kind of, you know, sort of like the pre-World Trade Towers in America,
peace,
you know?
And prosperity.
And everything.
Do it to you every time.
You bet. And we have all this extra energy and mental stuff to waste on frivolous things. And they did. Immorality was on the increase. People really didn't take it well. Religion was an institutional phenomena. And this combined with the fact that in Europe was the rising of the Age of Enlightenment, the worship of human reason. Was seen, as Chris said, you know, with Hume and those guys, they, you know, we can reason this out. I mean, we can make ourselves better through the power of the human intellect.
And part of that also was the fact that one of the things that had been lost track of was the idea of man's depravity. And one of the things that was sort of coming into vogue within the church was the idea of man's basic goodness, the old nine in everybody, and man's basic goodness emphasized. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that was going on within the colonial church at this time was people were being allowed membership and participation in the sacraments of the church without having to have any necessary proof of being converted. And so the church itself really had lost a lot of its spiritual power and fervor by becoming more of a public institution as opposed to a gathering and assembly of people that were the saints, that they'd truly been converted.
Mm-hmm.
Something else that was definitely going on, and I know, Matthew, you want to elaborate on this more, is just the fact that at this time, America had started to become more of a frontier nation, where we had people that were living in isolated places all over the colonies, you know, pushing back the forests and settling out way away from the communities. And what was brought over as far as the church from Europe was the parish system, which in Europe that works very well. Communities are very compact. The church is at the center. People lived in towns. They didn't really live isolated lives. And so the church was able to have an effect on the community, where in the new colonies, the church was unable. That was an ineffective way of ministering to people, because people were not really able to come to the church, and the church was ignoring a lot of people that lived out on the frontiers and the fringes.
And without any exposure whatsoever to mentoring or spiritual teaching, frankly, you know, the conditions on the frontier, as you know, Pat, were brutal in the extreme. You know, violent death was an everyday occurrence, disease, you know, Indians. People really didn't have the time to waste on frivolous exercises like nominal religion. I mean, it just wasn't something that was a priority. And this was a growing fear among those who were real Christians in the colonies. And they saw this, and they began to wonder, especially the pastors and spiritual leaders. And they say, gosh, we're losing this. You know, the whole church system that we came over here with is failing us. It's not reaching the people. It's becoming an institution. It's not an experience. This leads us to talk about what happened as a result of this. It wasn't an organized thing. Basically, what you got was men and women who were touched by the Spirit in their heart at various locations, various times, that said, this is terrible. We're going down the tubes here. We need to do something about this. And they began praying. They began talking. And sure enough, gosh, as early as 1702, what you saw were tiny little local awakenings. You know what happened in this church in Tennessee? You know, and then a couple folks would go on, visit some neighbors in Kentucky and tell them all about it. And then it would happen in a couple little churches in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And then something would pop up in Pennsylvania. And it was against this background in the early 1730s that one of the most impressive human beings in easily in American church history, if not the history of the body of Christ, rose up. And this man was Jonathan Edwards, a brilliant human being, He was born to a colonial family. At 6 years old, this guy was reading Latin and Greek, and I think he entered Yale or Princeton.
Yale University at age 13.
And then graduated first in his class 4 years ago. This guy's intellect, I mean, he made a complete dummy. This guy's brain is like, oof.
Definitely one of the even in the secular world, Jonathan Edwards is considered one of the greatest intellects in American history. The man was an unbelievable intellect. But one of the things that, as far as bringing Jonathan Edwards into what we call the Great Awakening, as a very young man, he took the pastorate of a church in Northampton, Massachusetts. And this is roughly around 1734. He begins a series of sermons in which he really begins the emphasis of God's grace, the emphasis of justification by faith, re-emphasizing some of the basic Orthodox Christian doctrines. And he begins to start seeing revival amongst the young people within his church, mm-hmm. where there begins to be a change in the conversion of heart. And this is some of the earliest work that God begins doing in the area of New England. And New England had, the youth of New England were definitely falling into a lot of immorality. As a matter of fact, out-of-wedlock births were very rife at that particular time. And so there was a need for a work in the young people. Something else that happens in Edward's life around this time is that he adopts John Locke's philosophy of learning, in which he believes in the necessity of vivid word pictures to accompany learning in the human mind. And so Edwards begins to employ very vivid pictures in his preaching, which really drive people to passion and to into some deep thinking about what he's saying. And so he begins moving in a way where he's really talking in a way that resonates with people's hearts and minds.
He spent his sermons. He actually said that he thought the ideal way to do it was to spend hours and hours writing a sermon, memorizing it word for word, and delivering it in that way. We've all heard of his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God,
right.
Which he gave that sermon in Enfield about 1741, and I reread it, and the word pictures are astounding, and he's just reading this quietly in a conversational tone, no dramatics. He was not a dramatic man. He was not a pulpit pounder. He was not a gifted orator. He's just reading quietly this sermon, and what, my goodness.
Just a sample of his fire and brimstone preaching here. He says, "There's nothing that keeps wicked men at any moment out of hell but the mere pleasure of God. Hell, the very expression of divine wrath, is prepared. The fire is made ready. The furnace is hot now. The flames do rage and glow. Unconverted men walk over the pit of hell on a rotten covering, and there are innumerable places in this covering so weak that they will not bear their weight, and these places have not been seen." It said in a written account of the delivery of this sermon that people actually in the audience, this is happening in a church, okay? This isn't out in a field or anywhere. This is in a church. The people begin screaming and feeling dizzy and passing out.
They're clutching at banisters.
Anything,
and
because they're so afraid that the gates of hell are going
to
open up and swallow them up. And this is one of the most famous sermons in American history,
and
it really becomes one of the peak experiences in this time we know as the Great Awakening.
And really, actually, kind of garnered Jonathan Edwards an unfair reputation for the fire and brimstone. That was actually a very rare subject for him to address. He usually camped on grace and mercy and the wonderfulness of coming to God. And even in this, again, he was not pulpit pounding. He was just reading it out, the straight thing, using vivid word pictures. And my goodness, the reaction that he got. Well, all this to say that Jonathan Edwards is probably the best, most vivid portrayal and illustration, if we can give, of what was happening in many places around the colonies at this time. Okay, so what you've got is this kind of backwards, immoral, beat-up frontier civilization. And spiritually speaking, a number of inspired men and women are starting the pot to bubble here. Things are getting.
Okay, this was in New England, not in Boston.
Oh, actually, this is spread all over.
It started in Massachusetts, but then Edwards really comes into prominence when he's invited to come speak in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives the sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, around 1741.
Just for clarity, let me just remind everybody that this whole Great Awakening thing, these are clusters of awakenings. These are occurring all over the colonies all the time, some in smaller numbers, some in greater numbers, some in less frequency, more frequency. What we call the Great Awakening, or the Second Great Awakening later in the 1800s, and the Third Great Awakening just before the Civil War, are just a little bit more densely packed occurrences of these awakenings, but there you can't really pin it down.
Well, so like everything else in history, when it's happening, you have no awareness of what to call it.
Absolutely,
right? We call it the awakening in retrospect.
We look back and see a pattern, but the top of the boiling pot of Edwards in Massachusetts and Connecticut here.
Okay,
and this is he actually gave that sermon in 1741. Well, just a few years prior to that, and the pot's still bubbling here. We have introduced into the mix a man named George Whitfield, who is an English Anglican guy. Gosh, son of a tavern keeper. He really was, as a kid, he was in love with the theater and practiced all his drama and oratory, but came to Christ at a very early age. Actually fell in with the Wesleys, didn't he, at Oxford?
Yes, he's a contemporary of the Wesleys, knew them well. They had a warm friendship. And
he was English, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah. And Whitfield gets invited, actually, to come and... And actually, no, he comes and begins a series of talks in Connecticut, but then he gets invited, actually, to begin even lecturing in churches.
Well, even before this, in England, he gets himself into trouble because he's such an orator. He's so dramatic. He's the complete opposite of Jonathan Edwards.
Okay.
He's first ordained as a deacon in the Anglican Church, and they say, okay, son, here, go out and do a few of these. And he gets such a response. People are just jumping up and down and weeping and wailing, a very Pentecostal response. Well, you can imagine how this went over with the Anglican fathers.
Yes.
Well, it wasn't long. He was blacklisted. No church would have him. And so he did a revolutionary thing. He went out in a field and preached the gospel of Christ. Can you imagine? Shameful.
Well,
shameful.
I imagine some of those people wigged out.
Oh, no. Oh, God. The wig thing again. Don't get him started, Pat. Well, this, I got to tell you, this was so successful. He was preaching to larger and larger crowds. He really did become a phenomenon. Within a year or two, he was the talk of England. This kid, you know, this barefaced kid was drawing huge crowds out in fields. It was scandalous. And it wasn't long, like I say, what Chris said, he received invitations, hey, come on over to the United States. You know, we like all that get down weird stuff. And by golly, over he went. And did he go to Philadelphia first?
I don't think he was in Philadelphia. I think Connecticut is the very first part. He was all over the colonies at the time. But
well, he made 14 trips back and forth across, just to give you an idea. But his first one, he came in, started talking, and he also got the pot bubbling more. But it was Whitfield more than anybody else, because every time he came over here on many trips, he just would travel up and down the seacoast, up and down the colonies. And it was such a thing because people had started to hear of him. He became more and more of a star. Truthfully, what he did was what Billy Graham does today. Almost exactly. It's almost a transparency sheet you could lay over the assembly, the outdoor assembly. His message was very simple, very cross-denominational. If you believed and trusted in Jesus Christ, then you were going to heaven. And that was the end of the doctrinal difficulties. And people got so hyped up about this that by about the third or fourth trip, by about 1740, that's when all this really started to take off. And huge awakenings began to happen. I mean, he'd go into a town with a population of 800 people, mm-hmm. and he'd find 7,500 people there waiting for him because everybody had heard. I got one great story. I just was reading this morning a journal of a farmer who got on his plow horse, and he'd just gotten the word at the last minute, oh, my gosh, Whitfield's going to be in. So he jumps on his plow horse, whips the poor thing half to death, getting to Stockbridge, and the whole time he's getting there at a full gallop on his plow horse, his heart is boiling and burning inside. He knows he's going to be confronted with a conviction of the Spirit. He knows he's going to be receiving oratory from a man that's going to change his life. By the time he gets there, he hasn't heard Whitfield say a word. He's already had a religious experience. This guy is so primed. Now, you multiply that by crowds of 8,000, which in colonial America was insane. It was unheard of. It was like
the Rolling Stones almost, some superstar, you know, musical performer. It's George Whitfield and his preaching.
And all this without benefit of a microphone.
Absolutely.
His friend, Benjamin Franklin, that's another great story. Well, Ben Franklin came one day to scoff. And I love Ben Franklin, but he was kind of a cynic. And he came to scoff at Whitfield one day. And Whitfield was raising money for an orphanage in Georgia that he funded. And Ben Franklin recalls in his journal that about a third of the way through, Ben, in spite of his skepticism, had decided, well, he was going to give all his copper coins in his pocket. And about halfway through, he decided, well, that's pretty stingy. I guess I better give the silver coins, too. By the end of the sermon, Ben Franklin's in tears. He's dumping all his gold coins.
and he offers to become George Whitfield's publicist, and actually does. He actually published Whitfield's sermons, even though he himself was not exactly a real ardent and orthodox believer of any kind. He loved Whitfield and saw his potential, you know.
Yes.
It's said that Whitfield was such a good preacher that even when he used the word Mesopotamia, that it would bring people to tears. I mean, this is quite the orator.
The famous English actor David Garrick once said that he would give £100 sterling to be able to say the word, oh, like Whitfield.
He just said,
it was so expressive. And Ben Franklin once calculated scientifically that Whitfield's voice could probably address a crowd of 30,000. Now, 25,000 is the largest we understand that he addressed, but there is
amazing.
Recorded one man was converted at the distance of 3 miles. He was in another village entirely and was listening to the echo of Whitfield's voice, and his heart was changed. He gave his life to Christ.
Might have been a God thing.
I'm thinking it's a God thing.
Some sort of God thing. Yeah. But, you know, Pat, there were a lot of people involved in this. We've only really the time to share these two great personalities, but lest we, you know, mislead anybody, you know, there were many, hundreds of different people and preachers, and they all had kind of the same result. You know, there was the itinerant preaching that was going on outside of the church frequently, sometimes within the church. There were thousands of people becoming converted and this having a lasting effect. there was always an emphasis on God's grace and upon repentance and upon coming to salvation. There was a return to the need for conversion that had kind of been lost in the current preaching of the particular time. Which kind of brings us then to some of the effects of this time period, because it did have a very profound effect, the Great Awakening did, on the American landscape and some of even our points of view today. Wouldn't you say, Matt?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Just for fun, the two smaller ones that occurred to us, one was it really stimulated education. It really got people involved in religion again. Church membership just exploded. Universities popped up all over the place. Rutgers, Dartmouth, Princeton, just to name a few. It had a huge impact on that. Because basically, by the time he was done, 10 million colonists had seen Whitfield. 80% of the human beings on this continent had personally heard and looked at this man. It really gave a common view of evangelism, really stirred the awakening. The other is it really began a massive increase in social reform. My goodness, child and labor laws, the treatment of Indians, slavery. Whitfield was the first to actually say that the blacks had souls and began preaching to them. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he supported slavery. He said, you know, don't try and get out of the service of the flesh. And, you know, nobody's perfect. But for a man of his time, he was revolutionary in that way. He went to everybody and preached to them. But probably the single biggest thing he did was, and Edwards and all of these folks, was they took what had become a cold intellectual exercise, an institutional church, and really yanked it out of the government's hands and gave it back to the people. And it once again became a phenomena synthesizing the heart and the mind. It was it was crucial, because that really became the American religion.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the things that really struck me about this, was the fact that the religion of today, if you take a look at the strongest version of Christianity in America, it is definitely the religion of the mind and the heart. Mm-hmm. And that is what has always played well and is so much a part of our psyche, and this is really the result of the First Great Awakening.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other fruits that we see is in our lives today is when it came time to become a nation, we end up seeing the phenomena of the separation of church and state, which is kind of interesting because, you know, the Puritans, when they came here, were fleeing a state church in Europe, and yet that is what they brought over and established here in the American colonies, was a state-run church. The state church actually kind of was a part of the Great Awakening to begin with, but later turned against it and actually sought to actively quench it out, mm-hmm. by outlawing such things as itinerant preachers and meetings held outside of churches and that sort of thing, and began regulating the spiritual lives. And we see, because the Awakening was such a huge unifying thing in the American colonies at the time, that by the time it comes to nationhood, that sensibility of having the government running the church just didn't fly here anymore. And so, consequently, we see down the road, this whole ideal and doctrine of separation of church and state in our country.
Boy, there's so much, Pat, we could talk about. The parallels that could be drawn with the modern renewal movement. Some folks just went too far out over the edge, and some folks didn't even want to examine the issues. And the real folks that were pursuing discipleship always looked at biblical integrity and the fruit of the Spirit. Edwards, Whitfield, the simplicity of devotion to Christ. And actually, for folks who are interested, there's a ton of material on Jonathan Edwards they can find in any bookstore. Any favorites, Chris?
Gerstner's Mini Theology of Jonathan Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you guys, thanks. We're just going to have more on Jonathan Edwards and George Whitfield, and we will do more. But we'll have to wait a while on that. Thanks again to Matt McAuliffe and Chris White here, our pals with Church History. I'm Pat Daly, and you're listening to KDUB.